Welcome to the Marty and Laura Show. We're so excited to be joining you. We're here to talk about your dogs, your cats, and maybe even some small critters. Anything you've got a question?
We've got answers for all of it.
The Marty and Laura Show is brought to you by Veterinary Village. With locations throughout Wisconsin, Veterinary Village is dedicated to enhancing the quality of animal and human lives today and into the future.
Welcome to the Marty and Laura Show. I am Laura.
And I'm Marty.
And we have some great puns for you today, you guys. We have reached the final episode of As the Eyeball Rolls, or...
Yeah, As the World Turns is now the As the Eyeball Rolls. So yes, who doesn't roll
their
eyes?
I can see clearly now. No, we're not singing. Once again, not singing. No. Laura, I got it.
No. All right. No, Laura. Off. Nope. Can't carry a tune in a bucket.
Nope. My mother told me that, and it's never been wrong. All right, you guys. We are reaching the end. This is our third and final installation on the sort of structure of the canine eyeball. And we're talking about lenses, so cataracts, and then the third eyelid, which is different than the regular eyelid, you may not know, and uveitis. Am I right?
Right. But I think this is our fourth episode. I think we've done four.
Our fourth.
We did retinas. We did eyelids. And
oh, yeah, this is our fourth.
And we did,
man.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Marty, yeah, we're cooking. Marty smacks me down yet again.
I don't mean to smack you down. I was just going through my list, which I made a list of things, which I normally don't when we...
I did. I made a list and scratched things out, and I just missed the one. So there you go. So lenses, which includes cataracts and a couple other things, third eyelids, and uveitis.
Yes.
So
three separate topics.
Yep. We've covered a lot of things, and we're going to get to the third eyelid, but remember, it's not the same as the regular eyelid that you're used to seeing. So let's start with the lenses and talking about cataracts, because I feel like that's something pretty much everybody has a sense of cataracts are bad and dogs get them. So can we talk a little bit about that and how we'll know if this is a problem or what we should be looking for?
So unfortunately, there are some dogs that have cataracts. Most frequently, if we see the cataract coming on quickly, it's due to diabetes. So these diabetic dogs in particular, cats tend to be a little bit more resistant to developing cataracts associated with their diabetes. But if dogs have diabetes frequently, almost all of them will develop cataracts no matter how carefully you try to monitor them and manage their diabetes with insulin. And we only have insulin as a treatment for dogs with diabetes. There is no other treatment. Basically, all diabetic dogs have what's equivalent to human type 1 diabetes, which is the juvenile diabetes. We don't have any other treatment for that. Cats, on the other hand, they do have now two drugs on the market from different companies that are oral hypoglycemic. Well, they actually don't make the glucose go down. They just make the body respond better to insulin. So we do have drugs that you can give a cat. And I've got one on the Bexacat product. That's a tablet you give once a day, and it's actually not that hard to give, remarkably, considering it's a cat. And this is not an easy cat to manage. He doesn't really like it very much when we look at him, much less touch him to draw a blood sample. So there are oral drugs that do treat diabetes for some cats, but they have to be under 13. They have to be recently diagnosed. They can't have already been on insulin. There's a whole bunch of rules about treating these diabetic cats. So they can be on insulin, they can be on these two oral drugs. But cats usually don't get cataracts. Dogs, on the other hand, the first symptom that you might notice associated with their diabetes could potentially be cataracts. I've had a couple of dogs come in that went from a clear eye to this beautifully opalescent, unfortunately non-visual eye because the cataract becomes dense really quickly. So we can see lenses that have cataracts due to nutrition. We can see cataracts associated with diabetes, and we can see cataracts that are genetic. Mm-hmm. So obviously people that are breeding dogs want to avoid breeding dogs that have genetic cataracts.
Right.
So that's why many of us go to the CAER exams, it used to be called CERF, and have our dogs tested so that we're not intentionally or unintentionally developing a line of dogs that has cataracts. So very important that people know that. Now, the other thing that's important to know is a lot of older dogs, almost all older dogs, end up with a cloudy-looking lens. And that's nuclear sclerosis. That is not a cataract. It's not going to progress to a cataract. It's not serious. It's just one of those weird things that sometimes...
That like old dog eyeball that we see sometimes.
Yeah. When you look at a dog, you know, when they walk into my exam room or you see them at the park or on the street or at your friend's house, you may notice a little white on their muzzle, a little snow on the muzzle, and you may notice that their eyes look a little cloudy, and that's nuclear sclerosis. It doesn't progress to cataracts. It doesn't interfere with their vision. But just like you and I, after we get past age 40 or 50 or whatever it happens to be, we don't tend to focus as fast. So it's a little bit harder for them to really have great, clear vision with focusing. But it doesn't progress to blindness. And I think that's really important because you can't expect the veterinarian to fix it. And then I have clients that come in, and I actually had one of these yesterday, and she said, well, can't we use those eye drops that they market to say that this will prevent your dog from having cataracts? And I said, well, do you think if this product worked on dogs, that your ophthalmologist might have mentioned that to you about your cataracts? And she's like, yes, of course. So we don't have eye drops that prevent cataracts, unfortunately. Now, what's kind of interesting about cataracts, and this is on the human side because people can relate to this, is many years ago, my dad went to Pakistan. He was on the Presbyterian Church Council, and the Presbyterian Church used to own all the schools in Pakistan. So they were in the process of divesting them. So he would go over to Pakistan several times to have these meetings with the guys that were working with the Presbyterian Church to hand these schools back to the Pakistani people. And there's a really high incidence of cataracts in people in India. Really high incidence. And I said, well, how much of that's genetic and how much of that is sun exposure? And nobody, I think, really can fully answer that question because it's probably a combination of both. But what I also thought was interesting is when people have cataracts taken out, you go in the morning, they do their little doodad thing, and they take out a cataract. They usually do one eye, and then they'll send you home and have you come back a week or two later to do the second eye. But in Pakistan, they keep you in the hospital, a human, in the human hospital for a week post-op. And my dad said, I don't understand if we can do it sort of as an outpatient procedure in the United States. Why isn't it that way in Pakistan? And the doctor said to him, well, when it takes you 3 days to walk to the hospital for your surgery, and then you walk home for 3 days, and then you have a post-op complication, and it takes you three more days to walk back, you are now 6 or 7 days post-op with a post-op complication. No, that's a bad idea. And I kind of framed it for me in a way that I had not really thought about how long it takes to get to the hospital if you live in rural Pakistan. It's a three-day walk, maybe even longer. So that kind of helps to frame it for us to say this is not a minor thing. Now, in dogs, they also do cataract surgery. It's a complicated surgery. It's only done by an ophthalmologist. You're not going to find Joe Schmo that's down at the corner vet clinic that does spays and neuters taking out cataracts. Like, that's not a good idea. Are there some people that would be willing to do it? Perhaps, but it's a very technical surgery with very specific equipment. So as a general rule, no. Joe Schmo vet is not taking out your dog's cataracts. You need to go to an ophthalmologist.
I'm going to go with no on that.
Yeah. And sometimes people will only take out one cataract. The first thing to know is if the dog isn't visual because of other reasons like PRA, there's a test that they can do called an ERG to determine if the dog is visual with the cataract gone. So that's number one. Number two is sometimes they only take out one because the dog is visual with one eye. And because dogs don't drive a car, they don't need to have the depth perception, and they don't read newspapers and watch television and all those things, it's not quite as critical that they have that bilateral, really great acuity of vision because they chase a ball in the backyard and they need to know where the door is so that they don't fall down the stairs. But really, dog's visual acuity, it's not that we don't think it's important, but they don't have to have the same level that you and I do to do some, like, work on the computer or read a recipe. So,
sure. And are all cataracts surgical candidates?
No. That's... You mean are all patients with cataracts surgical patients? No.
Well, yes. Not every... Are all the kinds of, because there's different kinds of cataracts.
There are.
And so that's kind of my question, like a juvenile cataract that develops into something, or I just know there's other kinds of cataracts. So are they all able to be surgically removed?
No, I actually had a litter of corgi puppies, and for some unknown reason that I still cannot explain and could not get an explanation from seeing three ophthalmologists, because I had four boy puppies in one of my litters, and all four of them had very dense cataracts when their eyes opened. And we took them to see three different ophthalmologists, and I talked to them about, well, can't we just take out the cataracts? Like, I'd be willing to pay for the surgery if I could have dogs that were visual, because several of the puppies were dense enough cataracts. These dogs were essentially blind. And the ophthalmologist said to me, well, we could take them out, but they still won't be visual because during the time that their brains and their pathways to their brain from their eye was developing, they didn't have a visual pathway. So they'll still not be able to see even if you take out the cataract because that pathway didn't develop. I'm like, okay, interesting explanation.
Weird. I said this at the beginning, eyeballs are just not a huge issue in the breeds that I manage. And so it's all of this is just newsflash stuff to me.
Yeah.
Is that a common occurrence in any breed? Never mind corgis.
Okay. No. And I could not get an explanation from anybody. I said, well, what caused it? And they said, we have no idea. They said, the only thing that you could do is one ophthalmologist said you could repeat the breeding and see if you had it again to see if it was some environmental thing. I'm like, really? The same dog to the same female? No, that's not going to happen. And the other one said, well, you could do a mother-son breeding and see if that, and I'm like, no, that's not going to happen either. So to this day, I don't know what happened.
But some kind of a congenital rather than...
Congenital because they were born with it. But
right.
We don't know that it was genetic because I've never, ever produced a cataract in any other line. And it was all four. There were four boys in the litter. So I don't know. It could have been sex-linked, but because we only had boys, I can't even tell you that. But there was absolutely no explanation. So sometimes Mother Nature plays very cruel tricks on us. I was fortunate enough to find four really fabulous homes for these puppies. One of the people that took one of the puppies said, oh, well, that's okay. We have a son who's visually impaired, and we just get really used to putting the ketchup in the same place in the refrigerator so he can find it. So we can live with a blind dog. I'm like, okay, that's very, very kind
Fantastic.
Of you. So there are definitely situations where I've had breeders come in and other situations where a puppy comes in and people are like, I'm never going to be able to find a home for this dog. And I say to them, be cool, be patient. And I honestly will tell you, God will provide. The skies will open up and in 48 hours, someone is going to phone you, email you, or see you. And they will say, oh, I'll take that dog. And it'll be the right home at the right time. And I don't know how the universe always provides, but you have to believe that somewhere there is a higher power that helps us with some of these crises. So we have cataracts, which are the density in the lens that they can't see through. We have nuclear sclerosis, which is a very mild change, mostly in older dogs. And it's almost always very even bilaterally, like the right and the left eye look almost alike. But sometimes cataracts will look denser in one eye than another, and they'll look like a marble that can be really shiny and really pretty if you don't mind that it's cataract. But the other thing that can happen is lens luxation. And that's where the little fibers of the pupil, so the lens sits in the center of the pupil, and the pupil is just a series of muscles that open and close based on the amount of light that needs to be let into your eye, depending on the lighting conditions. So in bright light, like you're driving in the sun and your pupil gets really tiny, and in dark light, it dilates. Well, in lens luxation, that lens, instead of it being that nice, clear, beautiful lens that's sitting in the center of the pupil, it will either fall forward, called anterior luxation, or backwards, posterior lens luxation. And it just falls out of that position. And there are definitely genetic conditions where this happens. It can happen from trauma. Most of the time it's genetic, that there's just a weakness in those the little muscles that hold it all together. And there are DNA tests for some of these in some breeds. So again, it's pretty interesting. And I
have questions.
I can't answer some of them.
So what you're talking about, do they then not appear to have a pupil?
No, the pupil's still there.
Okay.
It's just the lens isn't filling the pupil. So you can still see it, but you'll look in the dog's eye and it'll be evident that the lens isn't where it's supposed to be. So if it goes into the back of the eye, it tends to be less serious. The dog obviously is visually impaired from the lens not being there because that's what helps to focus the image on the camera, the film in the camera that's called the retina. But if it falls backwards, it's oftentimes not too big a deal other than the loss of visual acuity. If it falls forward, the dog is more likely to develop glaucoma. So that's kind of a big deal.
Okay.
Which takes us to glaucoma.
I was just going to say, and that's our transition, right, to glaucoma? Okay.
Yeah.
Because glaucoma is a big, big deal in dogs, right?
It is. And it's a big deal in people too. But the thing that's different about dogs with glaucoma than people is that when people develop glaucoma, they tend to have very small and very gradual increases in their intraocular pressure. So the intraocular pressure is what we measure to determine if a patient has a normal eye or an eye with glaucoma or an eye with uveitis. Uveitis is usually when the pressures are really low in the eye. Glaucoma is when the pressures are really high in the eye. Okay, so there's a difference.
Okay.
So glaucoma is high pressure in the eye. In dogs, it will shoot up from 15 or 20, which is normal, to 80 or 90, literally overnight in some of these patients. And they are, within 24 hours, these dogs are blind. If you don't get in to see an ophthalmologist or someone that has the skills to drop that pressure in the eye quickly enough, because the pressure on the retina, the film of the camera, will be so devastating that it causes the dog to lose their vision. And if it happens in both eyes simultaneously, obviously they're going to be blind. So this is kind of a big deal. In people, it tends to kind of creep up slowly. It'll go 15, 18, 30, and then, you know, slowly, if you don't notice what's going on, it tends to get higher and higher and higher. But dogs, instantly, within 24 hours, these dogs have lost their vision.
Hey, friends. Did you know that the Marty and Laura Show website has a special page just for young animal lovers? Whether your child is meeting their first pet or already dreaming of becoming a veterinarian, Kids Corner is a place to explore animals through creativity, curiosity, and age-appropriate learning. Designed for young animal lovers and their families, these resources encourage empathy, responsibility, and a lifelong love of pets. Start off with a free coloring page. That's right. A new coloring page is available regularly. Download one free and check back often for new designs. And if you love that free page, take your coloring adventure further with the 10-page Color Me Pets coloring pack for just $5. Each page is filled with adorable, breed-specific dogs and fun educational prompts that spark creativity and curiosity. This pack is perfect for kids who want to explore, who want to color, and who want to discover more about pets. It encourages careful observation, fine motor skills, and an appreciation for animals, all while providing hours of fun. Plus, it's an easy, printable download, perfect for rainy days, long car rides, or creative play at home. Artwork by award-winning artist Sandy Mesmer, the Color Me Canine Collection brings even more adorable pets and fun designs. Explore full coloring books available online through Sandy's shop link on our page. Visit martyandlauraShow.com/kids-corner to learn more.
Doggett simplifies the puppy buying journey by connecting families with the perfect breed and responsible, health-verified breeders. They are the only breeder marketplace that verifies health clearances and responsible breeding practices. Through their personalized puppy matcher tool and matchmaker services, they educate and guide buyers every step of the way, ensuring a seamless process and a perfect match for their lifestyle. From initial breed consultation to introductions with top breeders, Doggett makes responsible puppy ownership easy and stress-free.
Okay, so the way you know it's glaucoma, like you wake up in the morning, what does your dog look like?
So they will have an eye that looks too bulgy, bulgier than it did when he went to bed. So a pug, a Shih Tzu, those dogs always have a little bit of a bulgy eye. But this dog will suddenly have a bulging eye called bupthalmia. And then the cornea, which is normally clear, will look suddenly very steamy. So you'll get up and the whole eye will look like it's steamed over, like, you know, your glasses if you walk through a door from a cold outside into the warm. It'll steam over. And it'll be red where the white part of the eye is, the sclera, it'll be red with big injected blood vessels. So it's a very characteristic look. If you see that, especially if you see that in a breed that has a tendency genetically to have glaucoma, you need to get to see a veterinarian, preferably a veterinary ophthalmologist, but a veterinarian nonetheless, immediately and get that dog started on injectable and oral and topical medications to control the pressures in the eye. So it has to happen almost immediately or you're going to end up with a dog that's not going to have vision anymore. Glaucoma is a challenge to treat in dogs. It's a bit of a challenge. Yeah. They don't always respond to the meds as well as people do. It does require frequent eye drops. So it's kind of a big deal. And an eye that's gone blind from glaucoma oftentimes ends up being surgically removed. So when I talked to the ophthalmologists at the veterinary school, and I was talking to one of them one day and I said, so what's the most frequently done procedure that you do here? Is it like cherry eye? Is it taking out a cataract out of a lens? And he goes, nope, it's removing the eye. I'm like, wow, that's kind of disappointing that you're trained to do all these wonderful things with the eye, and then the outcome frequently ends up to be a surgical removal of the eye. So that's really disappointing. And most veterinarians that can do a spay or do anything of that caliber can do an eye enucleation. But you want to make sure that that eye needs to come out. You don't just say, oh, yeah, you know, this doesn't look too good, and take it out. I've seen some really remarkably bad-looking corneal ulcers, remarkable, severely injured eyes that do a pretty decent job of recovering if we can give them the right support. And that if your vet says, put the eye drops in the eye 6 times a day, you know what they mean?
6 times a day.
They do. Yeah. They don't mean, well, you know, maybe 2 here and there, and then on some days you give it 3. They mean 6 times a day. Mm-hmm. So if you do commit to treating a dog long term with a corneal ulcer, with a glaucoma, with any of those things, you need to really follow the directions pretty specifically.
Okay. And then you mentioned earlier uveitis. So is that our next one after glaucoma?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, uveitis is when the pressures are low in the eye and there's inflammation of the uvea. And the uvea is anything basically in the back part of the eye. There's anterior and posterior uveitis. So anything that doesn't involve the cornea, anything behind the cornea is basically uveitis. So we can see inflammation in the eye, and frequently those dogs have a reduced pressure, so a softer eye, a more dropped back eye, and, you know, just something that's kind of unusual looking. And the eye sometimes will look just sort of hazy. Like when you look into the eye, instead of it having this bright, clear appearance, when you look through the cornea, look at the lens, instead of the iris, which is the colored part of the eye, whether it, if it's a dog, it's usually brown, but it can be blue. If, in cats, it can be green, it can be yellow, it can be a number of different colors. If you see that just seems a little hazy, that very well may be uveitis. So you want to make sure that you are seeing a veterinarian if there's anything unusual about the eye. I don't mess around with eyes. I mean, we really do take eyes very seriously because you only get one good chance at fixing the eye. So you definitely want to make sure that you're getting in to see somebody.
Okay.
So glaucoma.
Right.
Glaucoma is frequently a genetic condition. We see it in Basset Hounds. We see it in Sammies. There's a number of different breeds that have it. And there are some tests that can be done predictively to try and determine how likely the dog is to develop glaucoma. And that requires using a special lens that the ophthalmologist puts on the eye called gonioscopy to see how big the angles are. Because in the eye, there's fluid. It happens. Everybody has fluid in their eye, right?
Right.
That's how your eye stays the shape it is. So if there's either too much fluid being produced or not enough fluid draining out because the angles are too narrow or their angles are blocked by inflammation, then glaucoma occurs. So I want to be really clear that there's a couple of reasons that glaucoma occur. It can happen from a genetic cause. It can happen because of a tumor. It can happen because the lens luxated. There's a bunch of reasons that that happens. So important that we know the distinction between those. And if there is a possibility of your dog having the genetic tendency because you have a Basset Hound or whatever, you want to see an ophthalmologist on a regular basis and have gonioscopy done and just see if it has a predictability so that you are really paying a lot more attention. There's a lot of reasons glaucoma happens.
Okay, so there is some, not really preventative, but a way to maybe stay ahead of it? Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, there's some predictability. Now, uveitis has a long, long, long laundry list of things that cause uveitis. Okay. So uveitis just means inflammation of the uvea. It doesn't give you a specific diagnosis. And we can see uveitis associated with leptospirosis in dogs. We can see it associated with Ehrlichia, which is one of the tick-borne diseases. Tumors can cause it. Autoimmune disease can cause it. Toxins can cause it. Anything that irritates the eye can cause it. In cats, it can be FIP. So there's a whole long laundry list. So if you go in with a dog that has low pressure in the eye, and they can measure this at most vet clinics, they measure the pressure. If it's high, it's glaucoma. If it's low, it's uveitis. If it's low, then they're probably going to come back in the exam room and say, okay, there's like 400 tests that we want to run on your dog or your cat to see if we can determine what the underlying cause for the uveitis is. Because uveitis, remember, what our ophthalmologists tell us is the eyes are the window to the brain and the rest of the body is just meant to carry the eyes around. Mm-hmm. So if we have uveitis, there's probably an underlying reason. So the dog may be harboring some other disease, an infection, for instance, that hasn't shown up anywhere else yet. Blastomycosis, a prime example of one of these things that can cause uveitis. So if you're seeing uveitis, then you're going to want to see your veterinarian is probably going to do some diagnostics, or the ophthalmologist may send you back to your regular veterinarian to say, run this panel of tests so okay. that you can figure out what the underlying cause is. So it's important that you don't just say, well, here's some eye drops. You're going to be fine. Go home. Pat you on the head and off.
Sure.
After there you go.
Sure. I think the importance of understanding what's causing the uveitis, right? The underlying, that piece of it is really going to have to be part of a major discussion with your vet, right?
Yeah. It's going to probably end up being a number of blood tests, maybe some urine testing, maybe some imaging, chest x-rays and so forth. So there may often be a lot of these diagnostics that get run. And the important part is that if you can determine what it is, A, your dog's going to save their vision, and B, you're more likely to have the dog stay healthy because the underlying cause has been determined. So I think it's important that you understand that this could turn into a relatively significant workup, but it's important that you do it. You can't just go, well, can't you just give me a bottle of eye drops, doc, and we'll be fine. Mm-hmm. The answer is probably not. We need to really chase this down, figure out what is going on with it. So I think that's important.
Okay. And so once we identify that, if you treat the underlying cause, then the eye problem will go away.
Generally.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So there's a number of different ways to measure pressure in the eye. And I think it's important that we talk about that too. Okay. The old way used to be called a tonometer. It's just this little, you can buy them on eBay as a veterinarian or a medical professional. It's this cool little tool that you put an eye drop in the dog's eye to numb the eye, and it sits this little plunger on it. It measures how deeply the plunger dips down into the eye with the weight on it. It doesn't hurt. It's not a big deal. We do this. It's not a big deal. But that's pretty low tech, and you can buy one of those for like $20 on eBay if you're a veterinarian and you're just
not
getting
like
started.
When we go to the eye doctor and they puff our air in our eyeballs and all that.
And we do have, we do have Tonopens. We do have the air puffy things, but they run like $6,000. So a lot of veterinary clinics are going to be like, I don't see enough patients, or I don't see enough patients with eye problems that I'm going to spend the money on it. Mm-mm. But really, honestly, every veterinary clinic should have the ability to measure pressure, if not with a Tonopen, which is that cool little $4,000 or $6,000 device, depending on where you buy it and which one you get, or a little air puffy thing, then yeah, you can always do it with a Shiatz tonometer, and they're not expensive, and literally they're $20 on eBay. So if you're going to a vet and you say to them, you know, I've got a Sammy, and I know that some of these dogs end up getting glaucoma. If that happens to me, would you be able to test for that? You want your veterinarian to say yes, and if they say no, then you say to them, please learn to use a Shiatz tonometer because they're $20. So, you know, it's not something that a client is going to go out and buy for themselves because they're not going to know how to use it and what to do with it. But I'd much rather use the old-fashioned one because I don't have to worry about the electronics, whether they work or not. I don't have to worry about if it was charged. I don't have to worry about any of the stuff. It's just this very simple device.
Okay.
So any vet clinic that has any kind of caseload would very easily be able to afford the Shiatz tonometer and learn to use it because it's not hard to use. Like, it's not hard to use.
Okay. Are we through?
So, that's uveitis and glaucoma. Well, yeah, I mean, I could go
on. I didn't want to get ahead of myself again, man. Yes.
No, I just want to make sure that we didn't overlook anything because sure as heck, if we do, somebody's going to come along and say, well, what about
this other thing?
We didn't get to
try really hard, guys.
And we're not going to cover every single possible ocular disease on the planet because it's just simply not possible. I could spend the next 2 hours talking about the different causes of things that cause uveitis, and we'll still not be done. I mean, brucellosis, I mean, there's a million things, but it's as everything else, you look for the horses first and not the zebras or the unicorns. You start really looking for the most obvious.
We've discussed zebras. They're out there.
There are. But this is why you have a good relationship with a veterinarian. Mm. This is why your veterinarian has a good relationship with an ophthalmologist, so that if something does come up, that you have the ability to get in, get seen, get things taken care of, and get some saving things for your dog's vision. Because vision is very important to dogs, as it is to us.
And the third eyelid is kind of an interesting structure in the dog that we humans do not have.
That's correct. But cats have it too. So do reptiles. So there's a number of different animal species that have these.
I'm trying to remember, horses have them?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think
and cows do. And I don't know why people don't, because they're kind of handy. They pull up when you're in a dust storm. They kind of help cover your eye, or if you're in bright light, or if you're not feeling good. A lot of cats come in just not feeling well, and their third eyelid is up, and you're like, what? And the cat may just vaguely not feel good with an upper respiratory infection. But man, that third eyelid like just like pops right out. And they look at you like, feel crummy, can you take me to the doctor? So the answer is yes, I can take you to the doctor. So third eyelids are pretty common to see issues with as well. Cherry eye, as you mentioned, is kind of a big deal. It looks worse than it is. A cherry eye is when the gland of the third eyelid in the inner corner of the eye pops out. And sometimes it's because the cartilage isn't strong enough. Sometimes it's for other reasons. But it kind of slides up and then flips over. And then you can see the gland of the third eyelid kind of poking out. And it looks icky, but it doesn't hurt the dog.
It looks a little terrifying, I'm going to tell you.
Yeah. And sometimes it'll be in one eye, and sometimes it'll be in both eyes, and sometimes it'll come and go. Sometimes we'll put a numbing drop in the eye and then pull up the third eyelid and kind of tuck it back in. And sometimes it'll stay. Sometimes it doesn't stay in position long enough to get back up to the car. And so then we start talking about whether we need to do for surgery, all the stuff. But it's a relatively non-problem for the dog, but it's a problem for us because we don't like the way it looks. And eventually that pink fleshy tissue will darken and pigment. And then it doesn't look as objectionable.
It was
It's still not normal. So there is a surgical procedure. There's a number of surgical procedures to fix this, which tells you if one of them worked all the time, there would only be one. And so the original procedures that we were taught to do in veterinary school don't work very well uniformly, but there's a newer procedure now that I've done a couple of times and it's really slick. So if your veterinarian is hovering over your dog with a pair of scissors and it's a cherry eye, then have your veterinarian call me because I can hook them up with the right video to watch because there's obviously videos out there, but the original technique is very difficult to do. It doesn't work well. It's inconsistent. So I don't even try to do that one anymore. And it fails about a third of the time. And the problem is sometimes in the frustration of it all, the veterinarian is just like, fine, I'll just cut off the gland. Well, that is strongly recommended against because many of those dogs will go on to develop KCS dry eye as a result of not having that gland to produce part of the tears that the dog needs for the rest of their life. So they may not get dry eye by Tuesday, but certainly by the time they're 12, they have an increased risk of dry eye. So you don't want your veterinarian to say, well, we're just going to put an eye drop in, numb it, and then lift it up and take it off. Don't do that. That's bad. Well, it gets done more often than you would potentially imagine.
I was very fortunate when my dog was diagnosed. It had happened kind of out of the random blue sky. I was living in Seattle. I didn't have a really good vet that I liked up there. And I was going home and I happened to be driving down the highway past the veterinarian that was my vet when I was growing up. And I was now like in my 20s. And so I literally stopped at the office and said, please, 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 Dr. Ross, look at this dog. And God love him, he did. Oh my gosh. I did that a couple times with different things over the years. And I'd go back to what I trusted, like with my very soul, which was Dr. Ross.
Yeah.
And he's the one who told me the same thing you did. I mean, we can do this and this and this and this, but probably it's going to be just fine. And I was young and pretty poor. And the idea of trying to do surgery that wasn't going to work, I was like, I'm out on that.
Yeah. So Rhea Morgan developed a technique called the Morgan Pocket, and it works reasonably well. Sometimes we've been trained to tack them, but there's a newer procedure that I really, really love because it's so much easier. So there are definitely procedures that can be done. Sometimes it's just that the cartilage is a sort of a T shape. It's the T that kind of runs along parallel with the margin of the third eyelid and then a little leg of that T that goes down into the corner of the eye. Sometimes that's just weakened. And if you take the laser to it, you just pull out the third eyelid with the dog anesthetized, of course, and just laser across that little T part, this part, it'll sometimes just flatten the cartilage back out and it'll drop back in. So there can be relatively minor fixes for this, depending on what you got. But the other thing that happens pretty commonly is follicular conjunctivitis. And I learned about this when I was in vet school because I was lucky enough to have a case that came through the door with it. But I don't think a lot of veterinarians know about this diagnosis. So a lot of young dogs will have this, and they'll have this kind of squinty look, and they kind of look up at you squinty, and they'll have a little gooey stuff in the corner of their eye. And it's not at all serious. I had one employee who said, I think your dog is blind. I'm like, you're nuts. No, there's nothing wrong with her vision. That's her third eyelid. But a lot of young dogs get this. Now, the back of the third eyelid, it has a lymph node on it. And as the dog runs through life, exposing themselves to all the things that a new dog in the world exposes themselves to, pollen and dust and mold and, you know, stuff, just the stuff that life happens and your eyes lead the way, then these dogs will have this inflammation of the third eyelid, the follicular conjunctivitis, which is the back of the third eyelid. So essentially, what I do is put a drop in the eye to numb the eye, proparacaine, pull out the third eyelid, take a Q-tip and rub that. Now, this is not what you do at home because you don't have the ability to numb the eye.
Do this at home.
You just rub the third eyelid and then you send him home on an eye drop and these dogs resolve. And so basically you take this low-grade chronic inflammation, turn it into something more acute, put them on something like Pataday, which is a human eye drop that can be used for dogs. It's for allergies. You can buy it at Walmart. You can buy it at Amazon. It's P-A-T-A-D-A-Y, Pataday. It's every other letter is an A. And it resolves. So it's really no big deal. But I've had dogs that have gone to the ophthalmologist for other reasons. Mm-hmm. And they've gone in and said, well, I was told that the dog has follicular conjunctivitis, but I want XYZ checked out. And the veterinary ophthalmologist will say, well, who told you it was follicular conjunctivitis? And they go, well, it was Marty Greer. And they go, oh, yeah, that's right. That's what it is. It's follicular conjunctivitis. So I don't think a lot of veterinarians know about it. And I don't know why, because it's really, really common. But if you don't look at the back of the third eyelid, you don't see it. And that's sometimes where we do see foreign bodies. So we'll have dogs, like we talked about with corneal ulcers, we'll have dogs that come in, they've been out in the field, they've picked up a piece of grass or weed seed or plant material or something, and it gets tucked down in behind the third eyelid, which is, again, the reason that you need to go see your veterinarian is to get the eye numb, to get that little critter out, especially when the weather gets dry in the fall. We see a lot of these in the hunting dogs. So these dogs are really uncomfortable until you pull it out and it's like, whoa, it's so much better. Thank you for taking this thorn out of my eyeball. It's just this huge improvement. So they are commonly affected with that foreign body back there that you simply can't see as the owner because you don't have the ability to numb the eye and pull the third eyelid up and take a look. So important that you know that. Now, there's also rarely cancer that can happen to the third eyelid. I have mostly seen it in cattle or in cats. Cats will develop squamous cell carcinomas from sun exposure, especially white cats. And cows like Holstein cows and white-faced cows like the black white faces and the Hereford cows will end up with cancer. Yeah, they need glasses. Mm-hmm. So yes. Yeah. So yes, if you can get your cow to wear glasses, more power to you. My son used to put goggles on his dog.
I'm saying.
They make dog ones that are called goggles, and they do work.
Yes.
But there's not many people that would put them on their cows, so I'm just going to say. But there is a possibility of cancer developing on the third eyelid, but it's really, really rare in dogs and pretty rare in cats. So just to kind of frame it, I don't want to miss anything that's obvious.
Okay. All right. So, yeah. Well, I mean, I feel like we have really gone the full circle of the eyeball.
It is a round orb in your head. Yes, I think so.
Full circle.
You've done a great job. Yep.
I think so.
The one thing I realized that I didn't mention, and I probably should have, well, two things. One is the Shermer tear test, and that's a test. It's really simple.
We talked about in the first episode. Yes.
Yeah. So the Shermer tear test can be done before the cherry eye is fixed and just make sure everything is cool.
Okay.
The other thing that I know we didn't talk about was a contact lens use for dogs that have corneal ulcers.
Yes. We talked about it in the first episode. It dropped yesterday.
Did you talk about contacts? I use soft contact lenses for dogs with corneal ulcers.
Yes.
Because it serves as sort of a bandage.
Yes.
So if you have a corneal ulcer on your dog and it's not healing well, you can talk to them about whether a contact lens would be an augment to the medication. It doesn't mean you don't have to medicate the eye, but it's a way to help medicate the eye. So good. I'm glad we were as complete because it's not in my notes.
That was in the first episode.
We were pretty thorough then. I think we did an amazing job.
I think we did a remarkable job. And I didn't turn green and pass out any of the times. And so I feel like
it was.
There's a couple. Okay. All right. Well, Marty, thank you so much. We're going to keep it a secret what our next little series is going to be, but you'll know when we do.
But we will be open to listener requests. So if there's
absolutely
something special,
please tell us if there's another portion of the canine or feline anatomy that you would like to have dissected to the nth degree, not actually, but
not actually.
All right. Okay, cool. Thanks, you guys. Thanks, Marty.
Bye.
Thank you for joining us on the Marty and Laura Show. We're excited to bring you these unique, fun, fact-based conversations about pet health. From pro tips on selecting your new dog to what your cat's cough means and what you should do about it. We'll meet you wherever you are. In the car, on the treadmill, walking the dog. And we'll bring you a good laugh, a great story, and a bright idea
every week. We hope you'll join us on social. Stop by the website to sign up for an extra tip of the week for your pet. While you're at it, do us a favor, please, and leave a review wherever you find your podcasts. The Marty and Laura Show is produced by Pure Dog Talk, Inc. Sound design and editing by Premium Audio Services.